Darryl Davis is an accomplished black musician, a piano player. He's played all over the world with legends like Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, and B.B. King. He also has an unusual and controversial hobby. Darryl likes to meet and befriend members of the KKK, many of whom have never met a black person. Those friendships transformed many of their lives. When some of Darryl's new friends decided to leave the Klan, they gifted him their robes and hoods, which he preserved in a collection. A documentary film followed the journey of Darryl Davis. The film is titled Accidental Courtesy, Darryl Davis, Race, and America, produced by Matt Ornstein. And Matt joins us today on The Exchange. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners can join the conversation by email at jx@jeffnet.org. So, Matt, before we get to the film and the extraordinary issues it deals with, let's start with you and your background.
Sure. What would you like to know?
Well, how'd you get started?
My background, I started in music videos, actually, mostly, and then music videos and concert films. Then I sort of moved into what would later become known as branded content, but it was very early on. So there were sort of short documentary pieces about different people, kind of scientists and thinkers. One of them was one of the oldest Holocaust survivors, different things like that. This is for brands mostly. And one that I did well enough that it did some festivals, and that led to me being able to make a documentary about the last space shuttle launch called Atlantis. And that did well enough that it led to Accidental Courtesy.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Los Angeles.
Tell me a little bit about your childhood. Did you grow up in an interracial neighborhood or all-white neighborhood? Tell me a little bit.
That's a good question. I grew up in sort of West Hollywood and then Santa Monica. They're both diverse, but primarily white, but they are diverse neighborhoods, and definitely LA is a place which is there's a fair amount of crossover. People don't necessarily different backgrounds all hang out in the same places, but there's a lot of intersectional spaces, and you're certainly raised to believe that everyone should be in the same place, if that makes sense.
And how do you identify?
Well, I'm Jewish, and so I guess I can't speak for everybody, but never really identify as white in a traditional sense. You always identify as other, and so the plight of other is a similar background to yourself, or you think of it that way at least.
So how'd you hear about Darryl? How'd you two first meet?
I read about Darryl initially in an article. I think I was in England for work, and it was an article in The Guardian, I believe. And it was just such a... strange is the right word, but it was a story I had never seen before. And film is about telling people stories, but it's also about you want to tell stories you've never seen told before, or kind of give voices to different ones. And when I saw that, I contacted Darryl and wanted to meet up with him. And the next time I was in New York, I took the train down to D.C. He lives near there in Silver Spring, Maryland. And he came and picked me up at Union Station. And as we were in the car leaving the station, he started kind of just telling me stories. And I think I knew almost immediately that this definitely could and should be a film.
Well, you're a relatively young man. What's the difference in age between you and Darryl?
I would say maybe 30 years.
Okay. So what led to the decision to produce this film?
I knew I wanted to tell the story, and so at that point it becomes a matter of sort of figuring out how to make it work. My brother Noah produces film stuff with me sometimes, and he was the first person to come on. And then after he did, we sort of built around him some additional producers, leading to Roberto Alcantara, who is at HBO Max today, but back then was independent, and he was the final person who came on board that kind of was the glue that made it. You're sure sort of like forming a band each time you make a film, and he was the one that finally like made the cohesive group that made it work.
So I want to get a picture of this. So you've formed this team, this band, as you call it.
Yes.
And how many people are there?
I mean, the core band you're playing with in that instance for a documentary like that, it's the cinematographer who you shoot with, which was two people, Sam Guzzeri and Pete Castagnetti, sometimes the same, sometimes different. Then you have like a key sound person and you have your key producers. So you're maybe like a team of five or six people. And that's who you're really playing with, I would say, on a day-to-day basis.
Okay. So how long did it take for you to produce this documentary and how'd you fund it?
So this was a sort of remarkable instance. The first $50,000 towards making it, we sort of just pulled together ourselves between me and Noah, money I'd made from commercials and money Noah made. We got a couple of, you know, family friends to invest. And we really like scrapped together the first part to kind of do proof of concept. And then once we were able to cut together the first 20 minutes of it, we raised more money to be able to shoot more of the movie. And then it was accepted to South by Southwest as a competition film, of which there's like, I think maybe 10 each year. And once that happened, we got the last chunk of the money to let me shoot most of what's actually the third act of the movie. And that was done just in time to be able to show that year at South By. So it was sort of on a shoestring, and it happened in a pretty compressed timeline. I'd say the whole timeline for making it was maybe a year, which for documentaries is very short, but I didn't realize that at the time.
Okay, so about a year. And what was the total cost?
I would have to look it up, but it was under $500,000, I would say.
Okay. My guest is Matt Ornstein. He's the founder of Sound and Vision Productions, which produced a documentary film titled Accidental Courtesy, Darryl Davis, Race, and America. The film follows the journey of Darryl Davis, a black blues musician who befriended members of the KKK and transformed their lives. So, Matt, Darryl said this, quote, "The Ku Klux Klan is as American as apple pie, baseball, and Chevrolet," end quote. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, Darryl has a knack for making statements that are sort of provocative, but also once you examine it more deeply, are, I don't want to say unassailably true, but have a fundamental truth to it. I think what he is saying is not... He's not saying that it's a core American value that we can believe in, but he's saying it has been there throughout the history of our country and is as integral to a lot of the events that have shaped the position of modern society as things that we would think of more charitably in that form. You know, America's original sin, if you will, is slavery, of course, and so... That informs, I think, maybe more aspects of our society than we think about on a day-to-day basis.
So when you say America's original sin is slavery, you mean white America?
Yes. Well, America, we think of as the country, just America in general, even as someone who, my family is, you know, third-generation immigrants, we weren't even here during that time period, but if you benefit from the power of America, a lot of that had to do with slavery, whether or not you ever supported it. I should say the original sin is taking the land from the people it belonged to originally, and the other original sin is then building it with the financial power gained from slavery.
So theft, enslavement, and this ideology of racial hierarchy of valuing and devaluing humans by this mythological construct of race and white supremacy. So these are all part of what we're going to witness in this film.
I think we witnessed some of the consequences of them, certainly, without knowing that history. Darryl also likes to talk about if you don't know your history, you can't understand things. If you don't understand that component of it, it might not make sense to you. Might not make sense to you, but without that, it certainly won't.
Right. So tell me about Darryl's adventures through your lens. What were you witnessing?
Fascinating thing because, you know, we're... On, to some extent, what you're seeing in the film and what we did with him was that we needed to see for ourselves. Not that we believe him, but seeing is believing. And so some of the people you see him talk to in the film are people we set him up with that he had never spoken to before because we needed to see him do his magic from the ground up. And we needed the audience to see it too so you could fully believe it and understand it. So... part of really the journey of the film was seeing Daryl with people who we set him up with and people who he'd known himself for a long time, and seeing their relationships in person, and really trying to understand sort of what was so special and unique about that.
So these were real card-carrying members of the Ku Klux Klan, right?
Yes. Yes, yeah. So this is Ku Klux Klan, and some are neo-Nazis, but these are real people that were part of currently or had previously been part of hate groups.
Okay, and how did you connect with these people? How did you identify them?
That was complicated. Some came through Daryl. Some we found ourselves. My brother Noah would go on message boards and, you know, try to build relationships and talk people into coming. And, you can't pay people to be in your films because that's a conflict of interest, but you can sort of like, you know, you can get them to come somewhere and pay for their accommodations. Like you can figure it out, but it's definitely a real process. And that was sometimes very complicated for sure.
Were they ever armed?
Sometimes there was never a situation in which that became an issue, but that certainly some people are armed, yes.
Were you ever scared?
Never actually scared, perhaps should have been, but it was always a situation in which people wanted to have their time with Daryl, and they also wanted to be seen and heard on camera. And obviously, I have my own politics, but when you're making a film, you're there as a neutral, you're there as a safe space. You're there to depict and share things with people. So you're not adversarial in your approach. And people always treated it that same way, and it was always extremely... That was something that was very surprising, was how pleasurable the actual one-on-one encounters were. They were all sort of like, they had jokes to them. And sometimes you'd be reminded of how serious it was, but the actual experience of it was never threatening.
So I heard Daryl in an interview say that ignorance is the core problem. He said ignorance breeds fear, which breeds hate, which leads to destructive behaviors. And his antidote to fear, hate, and destruction is to resolve for ignorance through education. His tactic is proximity, getting to know people and helping them learn who he is as a person. And you got to witness this up close and captured it on film. What was that like?
It's a remarkable lens to view these situations through, because it's certainly, I think it's, there may be other factors at play as well, but ignorance is really what it comes down to. What he means by ignorance is just a lack of experience. The fundamental glue of Daryl's technique, that what makes it work, obviously he's a remarkable, engaging person, but he sort of figured out at some point a lot of these people had just never met anyone like him. They believed what they had been told about people like him, but if he was able to actually fill in the blanks with the reality of it, then it would change their whole relationship with the truth itself. And that's been very helpful to me since then. As the country's been so divided since then, and my project following up that had a lot to do with sort of the factors that led to Trump and the fractured landscape of America, looking at that situation as being a matter of ignorance as well is certainly a frame it's much easier to approach it through.
Through an ideological lens, do you think that the Trump administration and his supporting base are aligned with many of the ideological statements and rhetoric that you heard from the KKK in your film?
I think certainly some of that informs it, some of the worst aspects of it. I think mathematically that is not enough to form the coalition that he has needed to do what he's done. It is a portion of it. I would say that a disproportionate number of the people that believe that way also believe such things, also believe in his rhetoric. But he also has a lot of people who are just ignorant, who are being misled and going along with him for the ride. And they all get colored with the same brush, but I don't think they all believe that necessarily.
Do you think that Daryl's strategy of just getting to know the other side and they getting to know him, do you think that could work on a large scale?
In my experience, it has. But as Mark Potok from the Southern Poverty Law Center points out in the film, you know, it's sort of a Daryl strategy is retail, not wholesale. So it works on a larger scale, but individual piece by individual piece.
So Matt, as you were capturing the scenes for Accidental Courtesy, did the discourse between Daryl and members of the KKK ever get contentious or volatile?
Not between him and members of the KKK and such. There was always a real level of, a surprising level of mutual respect throughout all those conversations, actually.
I find it interesting that it seems the transformation only went one way. Was Daryl ever convinced of the ideological arguments from his KKK friends?
No, I think he's open to information being brought to him if it, you know, had veracity. There are certain individual points that he would concede on, but overall, the arguments being presented to him are not really logic-based, and they were not convincing to him or to us, I suppose.
So what were some of the arguments that you heard?
You have heard versions of them before, and they are largely economic ones that are sort of incorrectly blaming situations upon various scapegoats, I suppose. And some of them have to do with crime and are also not accurate. The thing is, most of these ideologies of discrimination and hatred don't stand up to real scrutiny. They just don't. If you want to be rigorous about things, if you look at them carefully, they fall apart in sunlight.
Well, that may be true, but they have been passed down generation to generation, and they persist.
Yes.
And we still hear the rhetoric and echoes of the past in today's political climate. So what kind of arguments were you hearing coming out of the mouths of KKK members?
You know, nothing again that ever really moves the needle. You'd hear personal things about instances within their own lives where they had situations that you could understand might have informed them having a particular prejudice, but you're never going to hear anything that makes you sort of shift your math on overall how you thought of the situation all along, because it's just, dare I say, fundamentally not true.
Well, listening to Daryl recite many of the stereotypical beliefs that he heard from the mouths of his white friends, I was reminded of Sidney George Fisher. Have you heard of Sidney George Fisher?
Only a little bit.
Yeah, he was an attorney, a researcher, and a plantation owner who wrote the book The Laws of Race as Connected with Slavery in 1860. He also endorsed President Abraham Lincoln for president. Here's an excerpt from what he wrote. I want to get your reaction to that.
Please.
Quote, "We must study the nature of the white man and the Negro. Of these races, the white is the highest in scale, the black the lowest. The white alone possesses the intellectual and moral energy which creates that development of free government, industry, science, literature, and the arts which we call civilization. The black can neither originate, maintain, nor comprehend civilization. He is by nature a barbarian. When in contact with the white race, he naturally and willingly yields to it and becomes its servant. The two races have exhibited these characteristics in all ages. The white race must, of necessity, by reason of its superiority, govern the Negro wherever the two live together," end quote. Did you hear anything remotely close to that in those conversations?
I mean, what I hear when I hear that is it's more eloquently stated, but it's just classic confirmation bias. You can say something because you want it to be true. It does not necessarily mean it will be so.
Was that part of the conversations you were hearing that from the mouths of the Klan members regarding what they believed about Daryl and Daryl's race?
A large portion of it. So they were simply regurgitating things they had been told because somebody wanted that to be the way hierarchically things worked. And then as that is put through the works, it sort of becomes clear that it is not actually true.
Where do you think this ideological belief, where is it learned? Where does it emanate from? How are people indoctrinated, if you will, into such ideology?
Well, it's on, you know, people are raised, you believe what you were raised in a household of. If truth is important in your household, you know, my whole family is everyone in my family is a lawyer except me. Truth has always been very important. So to me, that's the core value, but that's not how it works for everybody.
My guest is Matt Ornstein. He's the founder of Sound and Vision Productions, which produced a documentary film titled Accidental Courtesy. The film follows the journey of Daryl Davis, a black blues musician who befriended members of the KKK and transformed their lives. So, Matt, a lot of these members of the KKK believe that they are Christians, right?
Yes.
Did you hear that come through in the film?
I definitely heard several variations on that in various forms, but absolutely.
So who is the audience for your film? And have you approached white Christian evangelical churches? They're the largest voting base of supporters for the Trump administration. And have they seen the film?
We've had some interplay with evangelical churches, and some of them have been very receptive to it. Some of them won't even kind of open the door to this, but the ones that are willing to engage with this material, it's been very successful, actually.
When you say some will not open the door to this, isn't that the whole point of Daryl's engagement with the other side, is to have that door open and engage in a conversation?
Yes, it's a coalition of the willing. People have to be willing to meet you halfway. Anyone who will meet you halfway will can understand and benefit from it, but not everybody has been willing to, for sure.
How do you think this film would play in a political sense today? We have these ideological divides with progressives and with conservatives. They don't seem to be able to bridge that communication gap. Do you think this film could be used as a vehicle for that?
I think about that a lot because I still do, in the past years, I've had to do a lot of interviews with people along these lines, and it's been a real guide for me for understanding that a lot of times it's just a matter of you want to present people with information they have not been given before on a one-on-one basis and then see how they react to it.
So when you say information they haven't had before, this is seemingly going back to Daryl's point about ignorance, that you're filling a gap in their knowledge bank.
Yes.
And do you think that makes a difference?
I think that is the difference. And the fact that that's needed is a failing of the system overall, but that is primarily what has made the difference in all Daryl's encounters and the encounters I've experienced. The more information you provide, the truth comes to light.
Well, none of these adults who have this ideology started that way. They started as kids. Are we showing this film to our youth?
I think it certainly can be shown to youth. I've not specifically done it with youth groups, but I think it's definitely valuable for them.
Well, when we talk about filling in the gaps of ignorance, that ignorance is coming out of our K-12 system, out of our churches, out of our families and communities.
Definitely.
And so if we're going to fill in the gaps of that ignorance with knowledge, with real knowledge, wouldn't that be the audience, maybe a more receptive audience?
Take the example of Jeff Scoop, the guy who Daryl meets, who they talk about peanut butter. That was someone who was the leader of one of the biggest hate groups in America. They had never met before the movie. They met on set. And that day, that conversation, they did not change the world. But that began a process that years later led to Jeff leaving the neo-Nazis, and today he is an anti-racism speaker, and he's in contact with Daryl constantly. And we literally were able to see that happen in front of our eyes.
That's amazing. What was the most unusual or surprising experience during the production of your documentary?
There is a segment with Frank Ancona, who has since passed away, the one who was wearing the more ornate kind of KKK, the purple gear and stuff. Daryl and him had they were actually very close friends, and the tenderness and closeness of their relationship was surprising. It's still surprising to me.
So what is Daryl Davis doing today? Do you keep in touch?
Yes, Daryl is still he's a touring musician, but he also, you know, this is his passion and his project, and he talks about this and he goes out and speaks the word. And I haven't spoke to him in a few months, but he's out there spreading his presence, which is all he could do, really, I guess.
Well, how do you think he's responding to this wholesale political dismantling of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and civil rights progress of Black Americans?
You know, I have not specific. I don't want to put words in his mouth. I would imagine he is alarmed, but he also tends to take a longer view of these things. Obviously, things do not look great at the moment, but hopefully the arc corrects itself.
In your experience, and I'm assuming you do a lot of these media interviews, how has the media handled your film and the issue of systemic racism in America being as American as apple pie, baseball, and Chevrolet, as Daryl said?
It depends on what country. From an American standpoint, the response between America versus someone talking to me from another country about America are different. But I think there's sort of a tacit understanding that it is fundamental.
What is your hope for what audiences will take away from your film?
It is possible to have conversations with people that seem... It seems impossible if you look at it as a monolithic thing. Like, we just won't approach this topic at all. But Daryl's thing is, if you just crack the door a little bit, you can get it going, and then maybe you get some runway, you work from there. I would hope people can learn that. It's sort of the each one teach one, like, the little bit of daylight you can get, you take it. If people can possibly take that away in terms of race or politics or anything, then that is a better discourse than we're having currently as a country.
Well, a lot of the arguments that KKK members made in the film align with what's happening in our political climate today. Do you think that the attacks by the Trump administration and Republican allies align with the ideological positions of the KKK and its desire to restore the nation to a great white America identity?
Unfortunately, I think a lot of it does. And I also think this is sort of the last gasp of that style of thinking, of even the notion that that's a possibility. If you look at numbers, that even as a possible way of framing America is slipping away and has been for a long time. I view this as the last gasp of a dying empire's way of thought.
So the encroachment of a multiracial, multicultural society, you feel like that has created fear, and this is the last gasp effort.
I think for some people that is a fear, and they are preying upon that. For people who understand the situation better, they understand that diversity and inclusion has always been a strength, not a weakness. But if you view that as being a weakness, then yes, that this is the last gasp of that.
Well, I hope Daryl is right that the antidote to fear is, and the antidote to ignorance is, this knowledge. And you're working to fill that knowledge gap. And I appreciate everything you're doing with the film.
I appreciate you having me. And Daryl obviously does amazing work. Just happy to be able to share them with the world as much as we can.